Not easy to work out all the possibilities, but they're nicely worked out. In one case, it is moderately easy to figure out the possibility, and that's where we have two electrons. Because, I don't know, 1,000 times you have added spin 1/2 to spin 1/2 and got the singlet states and the triplet states, right? So these guys are, for example, up, up, or down, down, or the symmetric combination of up and down. And this guy is the anti-symmetric combination of up and down. So this one is symmetric under exchange, and this one is anti-symmetric under exchange. And that game works anytime you're adding up two equal angular momenta. So you're going to have a maximum possible value, and that's obviously symmetric, right? Those would be where the angular momentums were the same for particle 1 and particle 2, so it would be symmetric. And we have everything from the sum to the difference, and they just have to alternate as we go down. So the case we looked at before was carbon. So we have p electrons, so we have orbital angular momentum 1 added to angular momentum 1. So we get those set of possibilities, right, where this would be called capital S, this would be called capital P, this would be called capital D. We use capital letters now to indicate total orbital angular momentum. In terms of spin, 1/2 plus 1/2 gives us the triplet and the singlet states. And we need to have things that are overall anti-symmetric, so it's just a matter of mixing and matching. So we can have a triplet P state. And notice that the superscript is not, unfortunately, the value of S. It's equal to 2S plus 1. I think that's just history. We could have this state here, which would be singlet D, and we could have this statement here, which would be singlet S. So those are the three possible ways that the angular momentum in those P levels can be arranged to satisfy the spin statistics theorem. So all of those are actually realized. We're going to have exactly those three low-lying levels. Which one is going to be the lowest energy state? So Hund says the one with the maximum value of S is going to be the lowest energy state. The one that has the maximum value of L, other things being equal, is going to be the lowest energy state. So this D state is going to be lower than the S state. Once we've done all of that, we're not done adding our angular momentum, right? We've got total spin and total orbit. We then need to add the total spin to the total orbit to get the total J. And of course, the options are going to be everything from the sum to the absolute value of the difference. So in this particular case, we've got 1 plus 1. So that's going to give us 2, 3, and 0. So there's going to be a triplet P0 and a triplet P1 and a triplet P2. And according to Hund, this guy is the lowest energy state. And we looked at spectra that showed all of this was the case. Now, the energy levels by themselves aren't all that super interesting. We're actually interested in the photons that are going to be given off when we have electrons jumping between two levels. And not all jumps are possible. There's so-called allowed transitions. Those are the ones that happen most frequently. They're also called electric dipole transitions or E1 transitions. And there are rules that are written down that describe what goes on under electric dipole transitions. The most important rule being that the parity has to change. So one of the lowercase l's has to change by an odd number if we're going to have light emitted. Questions on atomic stuff? Going, going, gone. So we've used, everything here involves Clebsch-Gordendry if we were going to do it for real. So we're kind of doing the Clebsch-Gordendry in our head in order to make these states, or we're relying on somebody else having done it correctly. It is kind of a mess. Okay, so that was atomic physics in two lectures. So now we've got solid state physics in kind of one and a half lectures. And from there, we're going to skip to the end of this chapter and pick up the next chapter, which deals with how we can handle things like interacting particles. So, solids. Well, solids are complicated because they don't have spatial symmetry. They've got a nuclei here and a nuclei there and a nuclei there. So kind of the first thing to do is to wash over that. Think about taking the positive charge and just push it uniformly all over the inside of the solid. So now we've got a homogeneous system, and we know how to solve that problem, right? That's just particle in a box sort of problems. It's a 3D problem, and if we require that the electron probability go to zero at the edge of the crystal, then we have sine functions that are designed to go to zero. They may go through various number of waves as we go from one end to the other, and that's all incorporated in the sine. It's useful to have a name for the quantity that sits in front of x, and what you did in 211 is calling that k, and these things are then k vector, because we've got a k for x and a k for y and a k for z. And what the k vector does is it shows the direction that the plane wave is propagating in. So, I guess I'm not sure I'll say more on that. I remark that next semester when you do stat mech, you'll be doing all of these sorts of problems again. Concentrating on the statistical mechanics as opposed to the quantum mechanics. And it turns out it's a lot easier, instead of using sines, to use the complex exponential and to make something that's of the form e to the I k dot r. So again, we have a kx, ky, kz. And what those are telling us is which way this wave is propagating, right? So something like this corresponds to a wave that's going in some particular direction. And the k vector is pointing perpendicular to the wave fronts. Now, what's wrong with that solution is that it doesn't show any respects for the end, right? So when we impose the boundary condition that the wave function had to be zeros at the edge, that's when we got our discrete spectra. A solution to have boundaries but not require the wave function to be zero at the end is called periodic boundary conditions. And this is like old style games where when the particle goes this way, it comes out that way. And it should kind of work. One would guess that the physics would be the same, particularly for a large system, if we had periodic boundary conditions as opposed to having literally things bounce, right? So in detail, of course, it's different, but in broad sense, it's the same. And exponentials are way easier to deal with the sine and cosine, so there's a huge payoff in doing that. There's another reason for doing it that has to do with making connections with classical physics. So the sine function, right? So if we had a particle in a box, you know, something like that would be our wave function. You know what's happening physically is the particle is bouncing around between these two ends. So that wave function represents a particle that is spending half of its time going this way and half of its time going that way. And we like to think about things as having a velocity as opposed to having simultaneously a velocity that is plus and minus. So by using this sort of formalism, we get something that is going in a definite direction, namely the direction of k, as opposed to simultaneously going in the directions k and minus k. So we can make a connection between moving particles a lot easier if we use the exponential notation as opposed to the sine-cosine notation. Okay, so much for preliminaries. We're not going to go very... So this is not a... This is not a super great model. I mean, you can see these are huge simplifications. It's not a super great model of what's going on inside of a solid. So we don't want to take it too seriously, but at least it'll be good for demonstrating a little bit of stuff. So we know that we have states, and of course the energy of this state, if you work it out, it's this h bar squared, this k vector squared divided by 2m. So the lowest order state is going to have all of the n's be 1, right? You can't have n be 0 because then the whole wave function would be 0. And then we're going to have three degenerate states, which are of the form 1, 1, 2, where you can put the 2 any place you want. And I don't know, we could work our way through all of these possibilities. For example, I don't know, is 1, 1, 3, how does that compare to 2, 2, 1? Which one of those states is going to have the lowest energy? Well, it depends on the square. So this is 9 plus 1 plus 1. This is 11. This is 4 plus 4 plus 1. This is 9. So in fact, the three states that are like that are going to be lower energy than the three states that are the other way around. Well, I don't know. This is maybe a start. But if I have to fill up 6 times 10 to the 23rd electrons, I'm going to get bored of this process pretty quick, right? So the biggest Z for nuclei is, I don't know, what, 108, 109 now? I mean, that's a much more finite number than 6 times 10 to the 23rd. So I would like to count states in a much more efficient fashion than I'm doing now. And I may make some mistakes, it won't be perfect, but if I've, you know, putting in 6 times 10 to the 23rd things by hand takes a long time. So what we have is a trick of counting numbers of states relatively quickly. And it's a trick that is based on a brick. So I want you to consider a brick that is in the x direction. This is going to be a brick in k space. So in x direction, it has a side that is pi over lx. In the y direction, it has a side that is pi over ly. And in the z direction, it would have a side that is pi over lz. Maybe we could simplify our life and make the thing that physically be a cube as opposed to having lx and ly and lz being different. But it's not going to cost us much. So if we, with this brick in mind, think about K space. Right, so there'll be a value of K that is these sort of integer relationships, right? I put in 1, 1, 1, and that's the lowest energy state. I can try and draw it there. We're going to have another set of K's where we have these sets of values, etc. But the important point is that this first state, that's actually this point on the brick. So if I think about putting this brick in, there's one state at that location for that brick. And if I pile a brick on top of that, there'd be one state at that location. So for every brick, there's a state. And all I really need to do is to count the number of states that will fill a particular region. So all I have to do is lay some bricks and see how many bricks it's going to take to fill a particular room, for example. Okay, so having talked to Kyle, I should make a quick comment. What's the definition of state, right? So this state, I can put 2 electrons in, right? So I'm going to count things as a state spatially. And in the end, remember that I can in fact put 2 electrons in any one of those states. Alternatively, you could call a state to be a combination of nx, ny, nz, and the spin, but I'm not going to do that. What I would like to do is to kind of make the cumulative fraction, that is to say, what's the total number of states that is less than some particular energy. Well, the energy corresponds to the length of this k vector. So what I need to do is to figure out how many bricks it takes to fill in that eighth of a sphere. Now, if you think about it, the bricks are square and the surface of the sphere is round, so it's not going to be an exact calculation. But on the other hand, if we're talking about bricks that are sized 1/6 × 10²³ compared to the size of everything else, those are pretty fine bricks. We can do a really good job of approximating that spherical surface with these Legos, as it were. Really tiny Legos. Okay, so how many is it? Well, so the number of states, that's just the volume of that eighth of a sphere. And so the volume of an eighth of a sphere is 1/8 of the volume of a sphere. And let's call the radius of this sphere KF. F is named for the famous dead physicist Fermi. And I then need to divide by the volume of one of these bricks, right? Which is pi cubed divided by Lx, Ly, and Lz. Notice that there's a relationship, an easy relationship between KF and the energy, right? Because the energy, this maximum energy we're talking about is h bar squared k Fermi squared divided by 2m. Okay, well, I don't know, things work out pretty nicely, right? Because this is the physical volume of the crystal. And one of these pi's is going to go away, and one of these 2's are going to go away. So I'm going to have 1/6 π² times k Fermi squared. Now, typically, we're interested in the density of things. That is to say, a big crystal and a small crystal probably have the same electric structure. You just have more of the latter. So I'm really going to be interested in the number of states per volume. And you can see that that's going to be equal to 1/6 π² k Fermi squared. And if you want, I can express k Fermi in terms of the energy, right? It's not that big a deal. So we're going to have that k Fermi is going to be the square root of 2m times this energy divided by h bar. I'm not going to bother to plug that in. I'm just pointing out that the energy we're talking about is intimately related to the this is cubed to the Fermi energy. Okay, so if I'm going to put electrons in this box, then the number of states per volume is going to be closely related to the number of electrons per volume. Right, so I'm going to need half as many states as I have electrons, right? Because I can put 2 electrons in any one of these. So if I talk about the electron number density, so that's the number of electrons per unit volume, half of that, because I can actually put 2 electrons per state, half of that has to equal that quantity. Okay, so that actually allows me to calculate the, I'm going to call it the Fermi momentum, which is what, so k is really wave number, but if I multiply it by h bar, so technically this is the Fermi wave number, but if I multiply it by h bar, I get the Fermi momentum. And this energy I would call the Fermi energy. It's easier to say Fermi momentum than Fermi wave number. So I'm going to call this the Fermi momentum now. So if you tell me how many electrons you want to put in the box, I can tell you the corresponding Fermi momentum. Now what I'm describing is basically the same thing we did with the atom, right? That is to say, we put the electrons in the lowest available state. The only difference here is I'm putting in 6 times 10 to the 23rd electrons, and I'm filling it up to some maximum energy, the Fermi energy. Now, if we had a higher temperature, so in a low temperature situation, you put everything in the ground state. I take it you know that if you have higher temperatures, some of those electrons are going to be bounced, as it were, to some of the higher energy states. So if I plot the occupation number, that is to say, what's the probability that a state is occupied, as a function of the value of the corresponding energy, in the simplest case, I go from 100% occupancy to 0% occupancy. I don't occupy any of the higher energy states. I just occupy the minimum amount. If I have a finite temperature, then this thing is going to get broadened out a little bit. Some of these electrons that have almost the Fermi energy will be knocked up to these slightly higher energy states. But the key point, of course, is that inside the Fermi sphere, we still have basically 100% occupancy. And that has all sorts of important consequences. So one important consequence is it means the electrons can't scatter off each other. So this sounds kind of strange. So we have lots of electrons inside this box, and I'm saying it's impossible for the electrons to run into each other. Why is that? So if we had a collision between two of these electrons inside this box, then the scattered electron would have some new energy. But it can't have that energy because somebody else is already there, because we have 100% occupancy. So do you buy that? So because there's no place to go, the only possibility for these electrons that are far from the surface is to continue. If you can't go anyplace, you have to continue, right? It's a tautology. The ones that have a choice are these ones here, right? So if two guys collide near the edge, near the top of this energy bank, then there's some place for them to go, and so they are able to scatter a little bit. But the guys inside, they really have no choice but to continue. So this has important consequences for electronics, right? So the electrons in copper, I mean, those nuclei are cheek to jowl. Why is it that those electrons can go for great distances without scattering, without stopping? Where great distances might be a micron, but that's hugely more distant than the individual nuclei, and the reason is they have no place to go. So we automatically get an enhancement in things like the mean free path for these electrons, even though they're cheek to jowl. So the other thing that's kind of special about this circumstance has to do with the pressure of this gas, this electron gas. So what's the cause of pressure? Well, I don't know. What force?
Force pushing out in an undefined area.
Well, yeah, I agree. But what's causing that force?
Heat.
Say again?
EMF.
So these are electrons, so charge seems to be around, but these guys aren't charged, and we still have just as much pressure. So the electric charge, the electricity aspect of this is not going to play a role. Why is there pressure?
Could be the momentum in the electron hitting the side.
Yeah, so when somebody fires a machine gun at Superman, he's pushed back, right? From all those bouncing bullets, right? Momentum is conserved. So if a bullet goes here to there, he has to pick up that momentum. And you're being bombarded all the time with supersonic bullets, right? Those individual air molecules, they're bouncing off your cheek left and right. So that's the source of the pressure. And you all know the ideal gas law, right? So the pressure, well, we can write it this way. The pressure times the volume is equal to the gas constant times the temperature times the number of moles. But if I take the number of moles and I multiply it by Avogadro's number and divide it by the volume, that's what we've been talking about is the number density. So I've got the gas constant divided by Avogadro's constant times temperature. Gas constant divided by Avogadro's constant is called the Boltzmann constant, right? It's a more fundamental thing than any of those. So the pressure of a gas is the number density times the Boltzmann constant times the temperature. So that leads to the usual statement that as the temperature goes down, the pressure goes down. But think about these electrons bouncing around. At temperature zero, we said that that's what the occupation number looked like. So those guys are moving fast, even at zero temperature. So there's going to be a pressure even at zero temperature. So this ideal gas law is not accurate. If we have fermions, it's not going to work. So turns out you can write the pressure in terms of the speed of the particles, which is in terms of the energy of the particles. And the energy of the particles depends on the Fermi number cubed. So this pressure, and the books are going to have the details, it's going to be proportional to the number density to the 3/2. And independent of temperature, right? Because this is the pressure that something would have even at absolute zero. So if I were to make a graph of the pressure of a gas as a function of temperature, it's proportional to temperature, but then even at zero temperature, we have this pressure. So unfortunately, people have invented a name for this. They call this degeneracy pressure, but it's no different from any other pressure. It's caused by particles that are bouncing off your cheek. The only difference is that if they're fermions, they can't be at rest. Even at zero temperature, they're going to be moving. And so even at zero temperature, there's going to be a corresponding pressure. If these were bosons, then at low temperature, they'd all be in the ground state. And there would be zero pressure. But for fermions, when you let the temperature go to zero, there's still some pressure that's left. So it turns out that the cases where the pressure is the most in the universe, which is like inside neutron stars, the pressure that's there is this sort of degeneracy pressure. It's not pressure due to high temperatures, even though the temperature by human standards is pretty high inside stars, but the number density is even more. Okay. Okay, so that's the simplest possible scenario we can have for solids. How about if we start relaxing some of these conditions? What happens if we don't make this thing homogeneous? We actually realize that there are individual nuclei. And that turns out to cause a whole lot of problems. And we can't really work those out on the blackboard. And we can't work them out at all in a realistic fashion. So the plan is to, first of all, go down to one dimension. So instead of having a three-dimensional lattice of nuclei, let's have individual nuclei that are spaced along the x-axis. So we've now broken the translational symmetry. What's the simplest sort of potential I can have for my nuclei? What's the simplest of Schrodinger's equations to solve? Because I have to solve a lot of them, right? Got a lot of potentials there. So I better make it as simple a problem as possible. And I don't know if you did it. I hope you did it. The simplest possible potential, I would say, is a delta function, right? It's zero every place except at one spot. So did you work the problems of delta function potentials? Okay, so if you have a single delta function potential, make it an attractive potential, you might remember that the solutions were exponential and they had a slope discontinuity right on top of the delta function. I'm going to call the delta functions nuclei now, even though we're not talking about an electrostatic force. So if I've got lots of these nuclei, what do the wave functions look like? Well, if you're going to go to n equals 10 to the 23, right, a journey of 1,000 steps starts with one. So what do these things look like if we've got two of these guys? And I don't know if did you work this problem or not? Don't remember it if you did it. It turns out it's kind of interesting. If these two guys are too close together, there's only one bound state, and it looks like this. If these guys are far enough apart, then there's a higher energy state. That looks like that. We get a symmetric and an anti-symmetric combination. Okay, so if they're too close together, then we only have the symmetric state. If they're far enough apart, we get a symmetric and an anti-symmetric state. Well, how about if we've got three particles in a row? Well, it's not, you can kind of imagine how it works, right? You can start making symmetric, so certainly there will always be a state that is a symmetric sort of guy. And then the question about whether they're the higher energy states, is this the wrong, that's the right thing. The question about whether they're these higher energy states will depend on how close the things are together. But let's see kind of what we end up with. Okay, so this is kind of where we were reading. Here's the quantum mechanics. That's the isolated solution of this guy. And we don't have to go through this stuff, but the result is that we get the symmetric possibility and the anti-symmetric possibility. Okay, so this is a graph of the energy of those states as a function of 1 over the separation. So where they're far apart, we're close to the origin, right? 1 over infinity is 0. And where they're close together, it's out here. And you can kind of see that when they're far apart, we get the symmetric and the anti-symmetric cases are very close together in energy. And that kind of should make some sense, right? Because it will have decayed to almost nothing by the time we reach the other state. So whether it's flipped or not is kind of small change. On the other hand, if they're close together, then it's a big, it's a big sort of a big sort of effect. And I guess I want to comment We're not going to do the three-dimensional case, but the same thing actually applies to hydrogen atoms and hydrogen molecules. So you can think about doing the quantum mechanics of two separate nuclei. And turns out that's a solvable problem. It's really messy. I bet you will never in your life see it done. But as a matter of fact, it is a solvable problem. And in the case where they're together, we have a helium nucleus, and that's a solvable problem. So we can kind of see how the energy depends on those separation between those two. And this is kind of a connect the dots sort of situation. If we have a unified atom, we've got the usual sets of states. If we have separated atoms, we have the sort of states that I hope you talked about in chemistry class. So anyone know about sigma bonds and pi bonds? One person says yes. So sigma bonds are ones that are symmetric around the connection point between the two nuclei. And pi bonds are ones that are zero in a plane that includes that area. So they might be positive above and negative below. Right? So they're kind of like this as opposed to being like that. I don't know if that makes sense or not. There's a little U and G, and those are words that are useful to learn sometime. They're German words. Gerade means symmetric. U means ungerade, which means anti-symmetric. So I don't know. This just shows how these orbitals end up getting connected together. And there's, if you look at this in detail, there's lots of interesting stuff there, which we're not going to talk about. But if you want to spend some time thinking about it, you can do it. This is incidentally, since the hydrogen atom is exactly solvable, you can solve it. And turns out that there's a state, so this is now the total energy, the electrostatic repulsion plus the quantum mechanical energy that we've been talking about. So this is a state which has a minimum, so those two particles could nicely stick together. There's another possible state here where there's an energy minimum where the separation would be fine. A state like this, as you push it together, it just gets to higher and higher energy. There would be no such effect. So incidentally, this guy would be called a bonding orbital. This would be called an anti-bonding orbital. Lots of things could be said. This is the actual energy level diagram of real hydrogen. Okay, so we're trying to work our way forward to talking about solids. We did N equals 2, let's do N equals 3. And looks pretty similar, right? We just have possibly another state. If we get the things too close together, some of these states are going to disappear. And in the limit of very close together, we're just going to have the one possible state. Here's what those guys look like. Oh, so here I've got four particles. I think this is eight particles. What exactly do these states look like? So what I did is I focused on the case of A equals 4, which is also the case of 1 over A is a quarter. And so you can see that all of these states are pretty close together at that point. So here I've got 8 delta functions. Here I've got 16 delta functions. Here I've get 32 delta functions. And what you can see is that we're getting a lot of states in pretty much the same energy range, right? All around minus a half. It's also worth noting that we don't get a uniform population. The states seem to be concentrated at the top and the bottom. So in the end, we're going to be led to a concept called density of states, right? So now we've only got 32. You can imagine how this looks if I have 10 to the 32 states. Right, so I'm going to have these things very tightly packed, but per unit energy, there are going to be more of them there than there are there. And as I say, we can actually talk about the density of states if we want to. What do these things look like? Well, they look kind of like what you would expect. So this is the lowest energy in that collection of states. It's kind of the most symmetrical possible combination of delta functions on top of everybody. If I go up in energy, I start to pick up a zero. If I go up in energy, I've got two zeros. So I don't know, this should kind of remind you of standing waves, right? We've got This guy here would be the fundamental. Down here we would have the next excited state, etc. So all of these guys have pretty close to the same energy. This is at the bottom of those set. The one that is mostly anisymmetric, that would be the top of that set. Okay, so this is kind of a mathematical aside. How would you actually prove all of this stuff? So you might remember from, you know, months ago, the key feature was connecting the wave function across boundaries, right? So you set, typically what you were doing there is not delta functions, but things that had finite steps or things like that. So you were setting the slope and the value of the wave function the same on either side. With delta functions, there's actually a change in slope. But in any case, what you can do in general is to connect the wave function on this side to the function on that side. And once you have that general relationship, all you have to do is propagate it, right? So if I know how this is connects to that, it's exactly the same formula that connects that to that. So you only have to do that complicated stuff once and then just iterate it. So the upshot is you can put all of this in a matrix, and for a good wave function, the requirement is that at the far end, it only has something that's exponentially decaying, right? Otherwise, it wouldn't be normalizable if it had something that was exponentially growing. So you start with something on the far left that is going to zero at minus infinity, that is to say it's growing, and on the far right, you want something that is 100% decaying. So it's just a matter of figuring out what energy gives you that possibility. Okay, so it's possible to do this in a mathematically sophisticated way. And we get the sort of answers that you've seen. So how about we go to the actually infinite crystal, right? So, I mean, even though Mathematica will happily do n equals 1,000, it's still pretty short of 10 to the 23rd. So how do we deal with something that is actually infinite? If you think about what those wave functions looked like, it kind of looked like the wave function here was related to the wave function there by just being multiplied by some constant. There was kind of a phase that was accumulating. Or said differently, there was kind of an envelope that was one of these standing wave solutions, one of these sines or multiple wavelength sorts of things. So is there a kind of a nice way of relating the wave function here to the wave function there? Is there some nice sort of relationship? And if you think about chemistry, we usually think about the atoms in a solid as, you know, carbon atoms. So we could solve that quantum mechanics once. And we kind of think that the quantum mechanics of this atom should be pretty much the same as the quantum mechanics of that atom. They're all, quote unquote, just carbon. But what real quantum mechanics says is these wave functions have to be every place, right? The wave functions never sit in one location. They want to spread out. And you've seen how they spread out, right? They do this in this kind of symmetric, anti-symmetric sort of way. So how does this all work itself out? So I don't know, maybe we'll come back to all of this. The main story in this is what's called Bloch wave functions or Floquet's theorem. So Bloch is a physicist, Floquet is a mathematician. They both did it. I think Floquet probably did it first, but since he was a mathematician, we didn't care about him. Probably didn't know about him, right? So what happens is we do all the work ourselves, and then some mathematician says, well, you know, somebody else did it before you. It turns out you can prove that if you have a periodic potential, like you would have in a infinite lattice, the wave function further up the lattice can be related to the wave function at the earlier spot with just a phase difference. So Q is some constant that relates how the wave function at location x plus a relates to the wave function at x. And one of the things that means, and it probably gives rise to this idea that the quantum mechanics here is the same as the quantum mechanics there, if we take the absolute magnitude of this, it means that the size of the wave function on this nucleus is exactly the same as the size of the nucleus on that wave function. The only thing that's different is this kind of overall phase factor that disappears when we take the absolute magnitude squared. Okay, so this value q, which shows how the wave function varies when you take a step, that kind of plays the role of the n in the one-dimensional mechanics that you've done. It labels the wave functions. Different values of q have slightly different energies. And you might imagine if you change q by a little bit, it probably doesn't change the energy by a lot. So q is a continuous function, and the energy is going to be a continuous function of that value. If we wanted to approximate 10 million as opposed to an actually infinite set of lattices, then it turns out you can impose a quantum condition on that q. But more or less, I mean, 6 times 10 to the 23rd to a physicist is pretty close to infinity. You might as well deal with the infinite case. So the upshot after all the dust settles is this graph here. So, I don't know, so what do we see? So I think this is all done again for A equals 4. So this state that's about 0.5, the energy changes hardly at all when I change Q. If I were to look in detail at those wave functions, remember that the absolute value of the wave function would be the same every place, but there'd just be a slight phase difference. The phase difference would go as big as anti-symmetric. So that is to say, this guy here would look like a symmetric combination, and this guy here would look like an anti-symmetric combination, where the wave function here would be the opposite of there, it'd be opposite of there, etc. Okay, so pretty much the same energy no matter what we have for Q. This band here, the energy does change noticeably with Q. And even more so here. Most importantly, there is no wave function that has these energies. There's no wave function that has those energies. So that sounds a lot like the usual quantization, but heretofore the quantization had meant that there was one state followed by nothing, followed by one state, etc. And that's not what we've got here. We've got a whole band here for which you name your energy, and I'll tell you the Q value that has a wave function just like that. So this region where we have, you name the energy and I can tell you what the wave function is, that's called a band. And we can talk about the bandwidth, which is the difference between this and that. So this one here has a very narrow bandwidth. This one here is a very broad bandwidth. So I think at the bottom here, I kind of show you what some of these wave functions look like, and they're very subtly different. Well, that doesn't look all that subtle. That's because I think this is for pretty high bands. Do I do it for other cases? Yeah, so this is the bottom band, right? So the difference is whether it's anti-symmetric, so it actually goes to zero here, or whether it's symmetric. So the wave functions actually look very, very similar for any particular band. Well, what's the upshot of all of this? So if we have our n nuclei in a row, and I put the electron here, I mean, common sense says it's going to move, right? It's going to diffuse around. How exactly would we do that? And we do it exactly the way we do it with time-dependent quantum mechanics, right? So the electron being here is actually a complex superposition of all of these guys. We'd have to figure out what the coefficient was that gave us the electron concentrated here. And then in the future, we would just tack on e to the I omega t for each one of those wave functions, right? You've got to have done that lots of times. Okay, so that's mathematics. What does it look like if you do that? And what it looks like is, I don't know, pretty much what you would think it would look like, right? So here I start with the electron at one particular spot, and over time, it moves around. It has what's sometimes called the hopping frequency, but there's nothing hopping about it. It's just typical quantum mechanics. We start with a superposition of particles, and that superposition starts to look different in the future, but it's still just exactly the same superposition of states that it was before. It turns out what you can show is that the time it takes, kind of the effective velocity of this electron. So this is really kind of a funny statement, right? So we put the electron here and we see how long it takes it to go across. It's really all wave stuff inside of all of this stuff. If we look at its velocity, it turns out it depends a whole lot on the bandwidth. For very narrow bands, it takes a long time for an electron to go from here to there. For very broad bands, the electron's going a lot faster. So that kind of leads to the kind of chemical idea that what goes on in this nuclei is pretty much independent of what's going on in that nuclei, right? Because if I put an electron right here, it is going to take it a while for these deeply held states. It is going to take it a while for it to diffuse all over the entire molecule. Okay, on the other hand, for a highly excited electron put at this location, it does start to bounce around pretty fast. So the existence of bands and band gaps turns out to be critical to how things like silicon work in making electronics. And maybe I'll just give you one example of that. So this is a calculation that's done with a finite size crystal. I forgot, maybe 32 or something like that. And the problem I solved was reflection from that crystal, right? So if it's a finite crystal, there's an outside and an inside. And you can work the problem of scattering off of that. And here what we have is the reflection coefficient. So if I put in an electron that has this energy, it never goes inside of the crystal. It bounces off 100% of the time. If I put in an outside the crystal, if I shine an electron that has this energy, it can penetrate the crystal. It will go inside of it. There's some transmission, right? So it has a non-zero transmission coefficient. Okay, so where there are bands, that's where you can have propagation. Where there aren't bands, that's where you can't have propagation. Okay, so I'm way over.